Hi, welcome to the first episode of Amateur Hour, the AmDram podcast. My name's David Jeffrey, and with my co-host, Paul Ahrens, we'll be using this podcast to explore the weird and wonderful world of AmDram, the highs, the lows, and everything in between. We'll be speaking to people from all across the country, from groups of all shapes and sizes, finding out what makes them tick, and why we put so much time and effort into entertaining the public. In our first episode, we're joined by Nick Tobias from the Cheltenham Operatic and Dramatic Society, or CODS for short. Nick is currently the membership secretary and has been involved in the group since 2013, both on stage and off. CODS is Gloucestershire's oldest amateur dramatics group, and having been around for 130 years, it's probably one of the oldest AmDram groups in the country. And they also run the thriving Cheltenham Community Choir. Past shows for CODS include Legally Blonde, Calendar Girls, Little Shop of Horrors, Disney's Beauty and the Beast, Avenue Q, Annie, Sweeney Todd, Spamalot, and The Full Monty. But don't worry, we'll be keeping our clothes on for this episode. Not that it matters, it's a podcast. So, curtains up, and on with the show. Right, well, welcome, Nick. Thank you for joining us. I wonder if we could start by just telling us a little bit about your group. How old is it, and where does it fit in the kind of AmDram universe?
Yeah, sure. So, Cheltenham Operatic and Dramatic Society, or CODS as the abbreviation goes, has actually been running for the past 130 years. The very first production it ever staged was in 1890. It was trial by jury. And since then, the society has been staging, well, it currently stages three productions a year. Two of those are held at the Cheltenham Playhouse, which is a sort of local community-run, mostly volunteer-run theatre. But then we hold one large-scale musical at the Everyman Theatre, which is a gloriously built Frank Matcham theatre. And we kind of position ourselves, I suppose, as one of the, leading societies, not just necessarily in Gloucestershire, but probably in the country, not just in terms of how long we've been in existence for, but not to kind of blow our own trumpet, as many AM societies probably will have a tendency to do, but of the high quality of productions that we stage, which have been nominated and have previously won NODA awards in the past. So we obviously do have other societies in our particular county that are still in existence. I suppose the other most prolific one that we are, I suppose you could say, in competition with from an audience share perspective is the Cotswold Savoyards, who traditionally tend to do kind of classic musicals or Gilbert and Sullivan's, whereas we tend to kind of gravitate to a mixture of the big heavy hitter, brand new licensed shows that have previously kind of done stints in the West End or on Broadway. We kind of gravitate towards those, certainly for the Everyman slot. But we also stage plays as well. That's one of our three slots once a year. The society has also branched out into two other avenues. We have a community-based choir, which has been running for about, probably 4 or so years, maybe longer. And then we've also got, alongside that more recently, we have the Youth Theatre Division, which recently staged its inaugural production of Honk Junior, and consequently won a NODA award for it. So that's probably been one of our kind of our most recent highlights. To date, we've got about probably 190-odd members or so. And I would know because I personally am the membership secretary on the General Committee of the Society. So yeah, that's a kind of a little kind of brief sum up about who we are.
Wow, well, that is certainly impressive. I saw on your website in the past you've done things like Avenue Q, those type of big.
Yeah, we've been extremely lucky to get hold of some big titles. And what we try and always be, what we're very careful to do is try and sort of marry up the show with the venue it's performed in. So to kind of put it into context, the Playhouse Theatre, where we do two of our productions a year, one play in the winter and a musical in the autumn, it seats 180 people, whereas the Everyman Theatre is, which is your atypical kind of touring venue that seats upwards of 600. We tend to kind of make sure that space is reserved for the big blockbuster shows. So to kind of put, I suppose, a case in point, the show that would have got into the Everyman this year, had it not been for a certain thing called the coronavirus, was meant to be Shrek the Musical. And previously in that slot, we've done the likes of Sister Act, Legally Blonde, The Full Monty, Annie, And yeah, so Shrek was obviously going to be our next one in slot there. But you mentioned obviously Avenue Q, and I think the beauty of doing Avenue Q in a venue like the Playhouse as opposed to the Everyman Theatre is just the intimacy of it. And that intimacy has lent itself really well to other shows we performed in that slot as well. So the likes of which include Sweeney Todd's, Our House, 9 to 5, the musical, which I directed. And in the play slot that we've done in that same venue, we've done the likes of Goodnight Mr. Tom, One Man, Two Governors, which again I also directed, and also Noises Off as well.
Wow, there's a lot of excellent shows there. That's 600 seater audience capacity. That is giving me sweats just thinking about it. To be honest, how do you get on with filling that? Is that
Well, it isn't to say that we have had, you know, in terms of from a financial perspective, it's not as if we've had success consistently. Our last two Everyman shows, which were Spamalot and The Producers, both came out at a loss. And that wasn't necessarily meant, you know, a reflection upon them being inadequately filled by audiences. They certainly were well enough attended from an audience experience point of view. But I suppose the difficulty with trying to, you know, just the minimum is obviously break even, as I'm sure, you know, I echo this for a lot of amateur sizes out there, is that it's nice, obviously, to make a profit at the end of the day, but the end goal on any show is to break even. Mm-hmm. And I suppose it's quite difficult to break even on a show that doesn't necessarily have universal appeal. It may have appeal to those who are, I suppose, a musical theatre aficionados, and we do try and cater to those as much as we can, but at the same time, at the back of our minds, the one kind of demographic that we always try and persuade to come and see our shows is, of course, Joe Public. And Joe Public often is not somebody that necessarily frequents the theatre that often, or certainly sees, you know, musical theatre necessarily. So it is a very sort of delicate balancing act to try and ensure that the slot is filled by shows that are guaranteed, you know, bums on seats. In fact, I'm actually currently in the middle of an e-theatre summer school with Noda at the moment this week, and one of the sort of subjects we were talking about was the fact that when it comes to show selection, there's only about maybe probably like 15 shows out there from sort of years gone by that are guaranteed, you know, bums on seats. And once you've exhausted that catalogue, it then becomes quite difficult to try and find something to emulate it when you've exhausted all those options.
Yeah, I think the Amdram group that makes a consistent profit is a very lucky Amdram group indeed. We have a similar issue in our patch of South Liverpool, where over time, things like rent and performance rights, you know, they add up. And
yeah, and they don't get any cheaper. You know, there's always going to be, you know, levies or, you know, increases for various reasons year on year. So it does make it, I wouldn't say obviously makes it prohibitive for us per se, because it hasn't necessarily stopped us from mounting productions consistently. This is the only time I think, you know, this any amateur theatre company or any theatre company, any theatre as a whole will say that, certainly from my point of view, the current situation that we're in right now is the only occasion where theatre activity is kind of just ground to a halt. And, you know, I think, save for maybe, you know, a world war, that's probably the only other scenario where theatre kind of just sort of just doesn't get itself back off the ground as it usually is quite resilient at doing.
Hey, look, there's still a fair few months left of 2020. There's still plenty of time for a world war.
That's very, very true. Very true.
So in terms of, say, a new member joining your society, what do you accept, kind of everyone, or?
Yeah, I mean there really kind of is no lower or upper age limit, although I suppose saying that, it to be involved in one of our adult productions, unless we've made a specific requirement for a younger age range of performers to be involved, this obviously, you know, extends itself to quote unquote children, then obviously we would expect most members to join us at kind of like the sort of like the 18 years of age, the lower end. But we have members who I'm sure are into their, you know, 70s or 80s with us. And we obviously, you know, encourage anyone to join with whatever it is they want to bring to the table. It isn't necessarily performing on stage. And in fact, you know, I think one of the beauties of having the choir, either way, is the fact that we give this avenue to those who want to perform, but not necessarily in a in an amateur dramatic capacity. They want to perform, but merely to simply to sing, with obviously that kind of group chorale experience. So we obviously provide that platform, that avenue for them. But we encourage anyone to get involved, and whether it's front of house, back of house, on stage, backstage, applicants are most welcome.
And I am 190 members. You said that's a decent membership. Is that how many would you say are active on a regular basis, do you think?
I suppose it varies depending upon the season and what productions we announce and what productions are obviously of general interest to the membership. But I'd say in terms of a known kind of active number, certainly from kind of my capacity as membership secretary, I'd say it's probably around, this is maybe quite conservative perhaps, but probably about the 40 or 50 mark. Mm. I mean, certainly the largest size cast that we've ever had from memory, has been repeated in previous shows before, but I think it's around like maybe the 35 mark, including an ensemble. And it's not a case of it tending to be like, you know, necessarily the same people every time. You know, every show attracts new talent. One of the joys of it, and I can certainly vouch for that as a director, having both experience being in front of the table and behind the table when those audition deliberations are made. But I think there's nothing kind of more exciting and more joyous than seeing new talent walking through the door, and of course blowing you away with their incredible skills. But yeah, I'd say it's about 40 or 50 on average. We have kind of different categories of membership. The most common one being obviously a full member, which means they get the privileges that you would normally come to expect. So they have the right to be involved in a show on stage. They have the right to vote at the annual general meeting. They have the right to stand or be nominated for an officer role on general committee. And then beneath that, we have our recently forged associate membership, which is basically actually free to join. What that gives them is the newsletter communication that a full member would normally receive, so they keep as up to date as possible with all forthcoming shows and social activities. But they also have the automatic tick to be involved in any show or any production from a backstage or front of house capacity. And what that allows us is to kind of keep their contact detail on file, so that when we do come to them mounting another production and we need to obviously pull in the resources that we have, we make it very clear on the membership form in terms of what area of backstage they're keen to be involved in, in terms of like a choice of preference, ranked from most interested to least interested, and that way we can sort of tailor our recruitment process for those very vital roles.
And so you say that you charge your members. Does the vast amount of your money kind of come from ticket sales and membership subs? And is that, in a sense, do you charge per show, or is it an annual?
Annual membership to be a member of the society, but there is also what is referred to as a performance fee, or if you're in the choir, it's referred to as choir subs, and that's payable per production following a successful audition. And the way we kind of dress up that performance fee is that it's an all-inclusive fee that doesn't incur to the performer any additional costs outside of it, save for maybe their own personal expense when it comes to sort of social activities that happen during the show week that we tend to do from time to time. But a performance fee is going to basically sort of, I suppose, act as a top-up for the insurance as far as the production is concerned. It also covers the libretto hire. So, for example, if it's a show that we license via MTI Europe, then it covers the kind of the hire of the libretto and the script. It covers the refreshments that we lay on at rehearsals. And it also covers any contributions that they make towards the thank you gifts at the end of the show week to the production team or the choir master. So in terms of how that works out from a monetary perspective, we have a £30 annual membership fee, £25 is paid for via direct debit, and then the top up should a member audition for a show and is successful, or indeed if they join the choir and want to be involved in the forthcoming concert where there's no audition actually required, then that's a £40 performance fee / choir sub on top of that.
Do you find that you struggle to reach kind of any specific age groups or kind of demographics of actors that you would like to reach in, and have you kind of done anything to address that?
It's kind of a bit of a touchy subject as far as from where I'm coming from, because I think the one particular group that I would certainly like to see us attract more of, as I'm sure this would be the mantra for any amateur dramatic society, is certainly an increase of performers, or indeed, you know, anyone who wants to be involved in theatre, generally speaking, from a BAME group, and certainly and thereby increasing diversity amongst the membership. Because I think certainly in the kind of the era that we're in right now, and not to kind of turn this into any kind of like polemical kind of rant, I suppose, but when it gets to a stage where you're entering into this kind of whole like Black Lives Matter kind of movement, and certain titles or certain shows are being made available where there is an explicit need for a character to be of a certain race or ethnicity, I think maybe about probably 15 years ago, it might have been okay to get away with performing a particular character where there wasn't necessarily a need for that person to be of that particular race or ethnicity. But now I think that we're kind of past that point now. I mean, so much so, I'm not sure if you may have read this, but the license holders who own the performance rights to Hairspray, as kind of acting as kind of liaisons for the authors, they've now made it explicitly clear that should any society, group, whatever, wishes to perform Hairspray, then anyone who is to be cast in the roles of the likes of, you know, of Seaweed or Big Mama, for example, they have to be Black. Whereas before, they kind of gave a little bit of a get-out clause for that not necessarily being a mandatory requirement, but now it's completely opposite. And I think that if we are to ever even come close to the idea of wanting to perform shows that are amazing and would be amazing to do. I mean, examples off the top of my head include things like, you know, Parade, Kinky Boots, or Shook Up. Then I think that in order for those to work, what we have to do, and I don't think we haven't necessarily explored it fully yet, but I'm sure, you know, there's plenty of scope for that once this whole kind of COVID situation is out of the way, that we then try and branch out and increase our diversity by effectively kind of expanding our geographical reach. So rather than focusing it specifically on Cheltenham, we try and branch out to the likes of Gloucester, where there certainly, from what I understand, there certainly is a much more diverse and much more multicultural kind of population in that particular, in what is our nearest city. So
I think with amateur groups, you're always very much, you can cast the people who you've got. You get who walks through the door. Mm. And if you can't, if the play you want to do, you can't do because of you haven't got the people that you need, then so be it. And whether that's race or gender or age even,
Talent.
Or talent. Yes. Or talent. which we've found limiting at times, David, I believe. Then, you can have all the ambitions in the world. But you, as an amateur group, you get the people you've got, and there's not much else you can do. You can advertise, and you can try and open your doors a bit wider and try and encourage people. But I've always found that that is difficult, and you also have a loyalty to the people who are in the group as well. So I think as someone who's directed quite a number of shows, I've always found myself when I'm looking at shows, looking for I know who's in the group, and you kind of look at the shows accordingly.
We're warned of the dangers. Yeah, I can certainly speak up as a director of pre-casting. I mean, you can't help but not.
I would never dream of it.
You can't help but not. When you get given the gig and you're handed the script and you've already kind of started generating ideas in your head, of course the first thing is who's going to play these characters, and there may be a couple of people who spring into your mind for perhaps some of the I wouldn't say lesser principal, but some of maybe the sub principal roles, but I mean I the very first production I ever directed was a stage production of Fawlty Towers, and it was in three episodes of, and we didn't actually find our Basil Fawlty until probably maybe 3 weeks into actual rehearsals. So we didn't find him at the first auditions, didn't find him at the recalls, but had I not gone to the theatre, to the Playhouse Theatre, to see a production, I think it was called Words of War or something like that. And, the guy who was playing one of the characters in that particular show, the character he was playing wasn't necessarily comical per se, but there was something about him in terms of his physicality and his stage presence that I thought, actually, this guy might have something. So I literally, as I have done on maybe two occasions now, I think from memory, if I see someone in a show from another group or another society who I think has got it, I will make it my mission to go and track them down at the bar at the end of the show and say, right, look, I'm doing this. I think it would be great if you could come and audition. I'm very careful with the way I word it in that saying, you know, I think it'd be great for this part, it's yours. That's not what I do. I say, I think it'd be great to come and audition for the show because I think you've got immense potential. And it's paid off on both occasions that I've done that. Once was with Fawlty Towers, the other was with 9 to 5 Musical. So the girl who ended up playing our Judy Burnley was this girl called Amy Sullivan. So if she listens to this, hello. I was told to go and see her in a production of Anything Goes by another society. And I thought, yeah, why not? It can't hurt going to the theatre. But she was absolutely fantastic. And so I was like, had the first thing I had to do was just track her down to the bar and say, like, please come audition. And then sure enough, she got the part. So, yeah.
I'd give that a go, but I've been warned about approaching actors at bars after last time. so in terms of CODs, what would you say the biggest mistake the group's made that you know of?
Oh, well, I suppose it depends on who you speak to, ultimately. I mean, you may have some kind of, you know, members who begrudgingly think that, you know, the society may have made a mistake in terms of casting or something along those lines, maybe. I suppose the biggest mistake I think mistake's probably a bit of a strong word. I mean, I suppose many societies may kind of react to that in that way. But I suppose the biggest kind of maybe shortcoming, I suppose, if you will, that we're still we are aware of and trying to work on is not really, I suppose, anything from a production standpoint. I mean, I've been involved in productions where mistakes have happened, things have gone wrong, both, you know, for hilarious reasons and otherwise. But I think, in my personal opinion, I think the biggest shortcoming of ours that we are looking into doing at the moment is capturing audience data. Because I think that is going to be so key in terms of the decisions that we make. And also it kind of paints us a picture of where exactly our audiences are coming from. Like, you know, are they just simply coming to us from Cheltenham? I mean, yeah, of course, there are regular faces that we see at every show who follow us no matter what production we put on. We could put on, like, I don't know, Faust in German for all I know, and they'll probably still come and see it. I'd love to know if, for example, if us performing Shrek a mere, I don't know, few months after it's done its professional tour at Bristol, which is our nearest major city, and Bristol Hippodrome being the nearest major kind of touring theatre of, you know, 2000 seats plus, I'd love it to see if a family from Bristol fancy making the trip all the way over to us in Cheltenham to come and see our show, even though it's only been performed there, you know, recently, just as an example. And so what we're kind of try and explore, certainly for when Shrek does eventually make its way up to the stage. So we were meant to be on stage about a month ago. Not even that. We were going to be said end of May, in fact. We are going to be back on stage next April, fingers crossed. And we're hoping to kind of use that as our sort of inaugural opportunity to capture audience data in a way that obviously complies with the whole kind of GDPR regulations. Of course, we're not going to be ignorant of that. But I think that once we get hold of that data, that's going to be so key to knowing what decisions we make going forward.
I suppose if the biggest mistake a group's made is that it doesn't have enough data on its customers, that's quite a nice mistake to have, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know whether obviously this is necessarily the forefront of every amateur theatre group's mind, but I think that personally it should be. I think even theatres themselves have to kind of, you know, look at audience trends and look at what's working and what isn't. So in the way that obviously we have tried to be very careful in terms of picking shows that aren't too out there, that they do kind of follow a very kind of mainstream, one might even say kind of playing it safe route. But if we don't know that it's working and it's hitting the right demographics, then we're never going to know if it's worth repeating again.
Yeah, one thing we've tried that's been quite successful in the past anyway is, you know, audience surveys when they're sat down. So, you know, they're captive audiences, literally. And we find, at least in our case, and it's probably different for every drama group, that ours is by and large, 80% friends and family who know somebody in the cast,
yeah,
or in the crew, or our regulars who know us kind of as a group, and that's how we get people in. And we've used things like Facebook advertising, we've used things like leafleting the local area, and it might get 10% or so audience, which is great, but basically for us it's almost a direct correlation between the bigger your cast, the bigger your audience,
which is why obviously that we kind of jump for joy whenever the next show that we decide to pick involved kids, because for every kid,
yeah,
it's their mum, it's their dad, it's their grandparents, it's their uncle, it's their aunt, it's their dog. So for example, with a production like Annie, which we did in 2017, we had two teams of orphans. So obviously, as one team performs on one night or one show, it then alternates onto the next. So there's been obviously been multiple occasions where multiple family members will see the show more than once. And that's obviously then going to kind of cascade down from there. Another recent example of that would have been Good Night, Mr. Tom, which we did, which is our last full production before lockdown. But in terms of kind of profitability, that made over, well, I think it's about probably £8,000, which for a play, I just was absolutely blown away by. I mean, our plays on average tend to kind of make a profit of about maybe probably 1500, maybe slightly less than that. But I was like, how did this happen? I mean, okay, obviously, you know, it's a great source material and, you know, everyone kind of knows either the book or the TV dramatization with John Thor. But I think a contributing factor to that without question was the fact that we had a team of, I think it may have been like a dozen kids. And there was no kind of team A, team B. It was the same kids for every show, but it just obviously seemed to work. So, but there's so few shows out there that involve kids that we haven't already done. It's like, we can't do Annie again, having done it 3 years ago. The other society in our town only did Oliver very recently, so we ain't touching that. And we did it ourselves in 2012. And so I think we're all kind of just saying like, oh, please release Billy Elliot. And then finally we can do it.
We went through a spell of, we had contact with a local dance school. We went through a spell. They'd come in and do like bit of dancing for the panto.
Yeah.
And then we just started using them for every show. You know, just have some kids in the cast, and you know, you just, because it doesn't half boost your audiences.
It is actually worth saying that there is another company in Cheltenham that does also do musicals, but they are, I suppose, better known. They may kind of hate me for saying this. They are better known for doing pantomimes. And pantomime isn't something that our society, I at least as far as I'm aware, I've only been a member for 7 years personally. I don't believe it's something that we necessarily have done before. And whether or not there's any mileage in doing it, I don't know. I just think that probably the reason for not doing it is the fact that the way I see it is that the societies that we have in our town, they've carved their own little niche. So with the Cotswold Savoyards, and again, I hope they don't discredit me for saying this, they've carved their niche in performing classic musicals of the golden era and from occasion Gilbert and Sullivan. The other group, which is called Promenade Productions, although they have done musicals in the past, from memory, they've done things like Pajama Game. They were going to do Chicago, but COVID happened and they can't perform it anymore because it's about to go on a UK tour. But they have done a pantomime, you know, almost without fail every January, and you know, audiences do come and see that, you know, in their droves. And then, like I said, we tend to kind of gravitate towards the big kind of MTI licensed shows that kind of, you know, as soon as they land, we're straight on it. So we were like that with Legally Blonde, we were like that with Sister Act, with Shrek, of course, and most recently, only in the last 2 or 3 months or so, we were invited by MTI to submit an application and were granted it for the rights to Disney's Hunchback of Notre Dame in 2022, which is a huge, huge thing for us, and we're extremely excited for that. But that's where I think we obviously, you know, that's where we see ourselves in the general makeup of things. But whether we decide to kind of branch out and try and do panto in the future, I don't really know. I just think the biggest difficulty is just finding a viable slot, because the thing is that the theatre we would probably want to perform the pantomime in, which is the Everyman, it has its own in-house pantomime. Yeah. Which runs from about kind of late-ish November right up until January. And I think when you start getting into the realms of trying to do pantos once Christmas is over, or even pantos at Easter now, which is, you know, even knew was a thing, but apparently it is now. But yeah, I just think, you know, once you know that somebody's kind of got their stamp on the market, then maybe it probably isn't worth trying to tread on their toes.
Yeah, we're very much Panto enthusiasts. It's basically our funding model is, you know, Panto brings in the money, and then we can spend that on shows throughout the year that might be a little bit more interesting, but might not bring in a
yeah,
crowd.
We tend to reserve the Autumn Playhouse musical slot for the shows that kind of are a little bit, you know, they still have a kind of a mainstream appeal, but they are a little bit off the beaten track. So they're ones that we wouldn't normally necessarily go with a particular kind of family audience in mind. So your Avenue Qs and your Rents, certainly, because I was involved in Rent myself. I played Benjamin Coffin III in that. So I think we obviously I suppose in a way, maybe foolhardy or otherwise, we sort of pin as much as we can on the play in recent years doing as well as it has done. But of course, the Everyman musical, because it is such a huge investment to begin with, and we hope it obviously makes a sufficient return to then hopefully put on something that is a little bit out there, might probably make a loss at the end of the day, but hopefully we try and mitigate that loss as best we can.
Yeah. So you've mentioned kind of cast diversity and you've mentioned data, but what would you say the group's biggest challenge over the next 5 years will be, and what do you think you could do to mitigate
will
or
there,
address
will
it?
There be a theatre scene still around, I think. I mean, but the more I think about it, I think that you talk, if you asked me this question and COVID wasn't happening, I would say that on top of what I've already mentioned about diversity and, you know, gathering audience data, I think it certainly obviously is going to be an encouragement to find new talent in backstage capacity. So to kind of give you an example, sitting on our general committee of about, I think it's about 9 or 10 members, we had up until recently a technical manager, a vacancy which is now currently empty because the then current technical manager decided to step down. And we have obviously been sort of debating about whether the technical manager position is indeed needed on committee. And I'm of the opinion that it probably is, because I think if we're going to be trying to mount these really technically advanced productions, we need that person to obviously make sure that we're not going completely off the rails in terms of what we think is feasibly possible. And I think that without there being anyone obvious out there who can bring their skills to the forefront, it's very, very important that obviously we try and, you know, and find that person, which can only really be done through good and diligent data collection and engagement with the local community. I think where we are now and the times we're in right now, it's going to be the biggest question is that will we have a theatre to come back to? And it's not to kind of want, it's not for want of, you know, wanting to sound, you know, pessimistic or anything, but when there just doesn't seem to be, in my view, an end date in sight. I mean, talk of shows being rescheduled 2021 is all very well and good, but what if there is the so-called, what if there is the second wave? What if this doesn't go away enough for that to then, you know, allow theatres to reopen in the way that they hope to? Is, you know, I think is the biggest question at the end of the day. And you know, if COVID is to stay with us for, as some people, as the World Health Organization is claiming, you know, for years, possibly even decades to come, that might be a little bit, you know, outlandish. But what does that mean, obviously, in terms of, you know, in terms of opening up and then maybe having to close back down again, and it going to and fro one to the other? So that's how I see the next 5 years panning out personally.
What I find quite interesting is that even already you have scripts coming through, you know, from the grassroots that are COVID compliant in and of themselves. So they are to be staged in a manner that, you know, includes a 2 meter rule. And, you know, that's only one part of the problem. There's also the issue of audiences and whether people just feel safe. But I find it quite reassuring. It shows the kind of vitality of the grassroots scene that,
yeah,
yes, there's a global pandemic, but there's always a chance to write a script.
Well, the beauty of our next production that we are performing, which was prior to Shrek in January, February of next year, again, should, you know, COVID allow us to, is the 39 Steps. And although obviously a director doesn't necessarily have to conform to the author's notes of it being a cast of four, they can increase it should they wish to include something in the form of a mini ensemble. Our director, from what I know at least, although this may change, has decided to keep the original four casting, which is perfect to maintain social distancing when there are so few cast members by default. Obviously, it's going to be slightly difficult when we come back to start rehearsals for Shrek. You know, and again, if we can start rehearsals back for Shrek, and how we're able to ensure that the rehearsal schedule, in, you know, how that ensures that the right people are there at the right time, that, you know, that the people aren't called necessarily. We have to obviously be very, very careful with that. I completely agree with what you're saying about, you know, about scripts being, you know, drops that are trying to be as COVID friendly as possible. And it's going to be interesting to see how this all kind of pans out. I mean, did you watch the footage of Beverly Knight's performance at the Palladium recently, the Angela Webber's kind of trial thing that he was running?
No, I didn't see.
No. Okay, so Angela Webber, who's kind of been sort of spearheading the campaign to get theatres reopened again, but without social distancing in place, tried to kind of prove a point by actually staging a show. I say staging a show; it wasn't one of his, you know, musicals by any stretch of the imagination. It was just simply a live music gig with Beverly Knight, who's previously obviously, you know, played Grisabella in Cats and amongst other roles in the West End, you know, Bodyguard, Memphis. And she basically performed to an audience of about, I think it was something in the region of like maybe 200, 300 people, bearing in mind the Palladium's capacity is 2,000. Mm-hmm. And I think it just, and you just saw this kind of, from the images that were published, you just saw this kind of sea of seats with these covers over them with massive black X's across in terms of seats that cannot be sat in. And you just look at that and think that's a sorry state for theatre to aspire to want that. I think is just farcical, because it just completely saps the excitement and the atmosphere of what we've known for, you know, all this time to come to know and love. So I think it's going to be, you know, like I said before, it's going to be an incredibly interesting and very, you know, precarious next few months, if not years, in terms of where this goes. In my opinion,
yeah. I might have a little look at Goodnight, Mr. Tom myself, though, you know, going forward.
If it makes that much money.
I mean, call me a horrific capitalist if you want, but
we have seen both big wins and big losses. Like I think the most recent play we did that you did, okay, to be fair, it didn't make a huge financial loss. I mean, it might be a bit of a stretch, but are you familiar with the play A Bunch of Amateurs?
I live it.
No, I'm not actually.
So Ian Hislop of Have I Got News For You fame, and Nick Newman, they kind of teamed up to write this play about like an aging kind of Hollywood star called Jefferson Steele, who is booked by his, you know, his absolute cretin of an agent to perform as King Lear in what he thinks is the RSC Stratford-upon-Avon, but it turns out to be the Stratford Players in Suffolk, a very small kind of Amtram theatre company. And I mean, I suppose we picked it maybe perhaps a bit naively because a lot of other companies were doing it at the same time. One of my absolute kind of biggest, I suppose, kicks is to go onto either Samuel French's website or I think they're now rebranded as Concord Theatricals. And look at what productions are coming up, specifically in the UK, and then basically kind of keep a tally of what shows have been granted the most licenses. Because it's not obvious, because I suppose the rationale for that is that, well, if all these groups are doing it, then why can't we? And A Bunch of Amateurs was right up there. But yeah, that was a really, really tough sell, and it did make a loss. Not a huge loss by any stretch, but it still never made a loss. And I think we were just so used to being to making consistent profits on all of our plays, and this one was the only little kind of spanner in the works. But
we've certainly made a few losses in the last couple of years. We're trying not to talk about the government inspector very much, do we?
No.
That was a hard sell.
Great. So, okay, three final, very quick fire questions. What tips would you give to someone who wanted to start their own Amdram group?
Oh God!
Don't is not an option.
Don't do it right now because
yeah. Step one: invent a cure for COVID. Step two: start your drama group.
If it weren't for COVID, if COVID puts COVID to one side, I probably would say to them that if they were dead set on forming their own amateur theatre company, that they need to obviously be, they in a way that the other societies have kind of carved their niche, they have to kind of find theirs as well. So try and find something that other societies aren't doing or are not doing as regularly as perhaps maybe it should. So I don't know, if you wanted to basically form an amphitheatre company but specialise in a particular style of performance that you think could be exciting, that could, you know, engage with the audience and the community, then do that. The second thing, which I do more often than not, is read. Just read as many scripts as you can and try and you know, if a blurb or a synopsis of a play sounds good, then it is definitely worth pursuing, no matter how disappointing it may be when you actually read the play and think, oh, that wasn't really worth it. It's always still worth doing. And then the third one and final bit of advice I would say is start building up a good rapport relationship with your venues, because without it, you can't really stage anything, or maybe even think outside the box and think of staging performances in venues that aren't necessarily themselves purpose-built theatres, but could still, you know, be as exciting and engaging as anything in a 180-seater or a 600-seater theatre.
Second question, what play or musical would you love to do but you haven't yet done?
It depends from either an acting or direct capacity, because that's where my kind of sort of skills kind of have laid with the society over the years. I really don't know, actually. I'd love to do, I suppose, to both star and direct, we'll kind of kill two birds with one stone. I'd love to do How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. I think that show is just wonderful. I'd much prefer it to Guys and Dolls, personally. I think it's so witty and sharp, and the music is just excellent. So I'd love to either have a go at doing that from either directing or from being in it. And I don't really care what role it is. I just want to be in that show. So.
And I'd just like to say that I want to play King Louis in Jungle Book. it's a dream. It's the role I was born to play.
You've Come said on. This before as well.
I know. I just need someone with the vision to take it on as a director.
We'll talk later.
Oh, hello. I'm off to Cheltenham.
Yeah. We'll do like an Amdram exchange. Like, you know, I'll direct one of your shows. You can come direct or be in one of ours. Yeah.
That sounds incredible.
A bit like wife swap.
But yeah, a bit like wife swap, or like when you get like one of those French exchange trips when you're at school. Like, you know, you do it down the outside of you. Oh, but imagine having to stay in like the house of like, you know, one of the members, like for three months.
We've got some excellent members, don't you worry, we'll
I can assure you that ours are really happy as well.
And finally, what does Amdram mean to you in three words?
Amdram to me in three words, it means collaboration. It means getting to work with like-minded people. It means enjoyment, not just necessarily for myself personally, whether it's acting or directing, but also for the audience that you get to produce the work for. And I suppose at its base level, and it means fun. I think in a way, like there are some societies, and this is only again my personal opinion, who I think kind of lose sight of the fact that we do this for fun. Like there are, I'm sure there are members who obviously kind of go with the mantra of, well, I've paid my membership, ergo I must be in the show, and that's all very well and good. And I think there are some societies that still kind of maintain to that particular kind of school of thought. But at the end of the day, you know, we obviously want to, you know, create the best quality production that we can, but at the same time, we can't really lose sight of the fact that we are doing this for fun, you know. I hate to kind of use the phrase, oh, we're not getting paid for it, because I find that quite sort of dismissive. I think at the end of the day, you know, we are doing this for fun and enjoyment. So, yeah.
That's great. Nick, thanks for joining us.
No, thank you very much. It was great to speak to you, and best of luck with the rest of the podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks, Nick. Cheers.
So, that's curtains down on episode one. Thanks again to Nick from the Cheltenham Operatic and Dramatic Society. If you like the show, please subscribe. Share it on social media and leave us a review. It'll help us reach more people on the podcast feeds. If you didn't like it, tell us why. We're new to this and we'd love to learn what the Amdram community wants from a podcast. All comments are welcome, including constructive criticism. We're on Facebook as Amateur Hour: the Amdram Podcast.
We're on Twitter as at amdrampodcast, or you can email us at wiltondramagroup@hotmail.co.uk, and we'll put all of that information in the show notes too. If you fancy being a guest yourself, get in touch. I've been David Jeffrey. My co-host was Paul Ahrens. Thank you for listening.